session number 6799, rule number 2.
That's it. And you like?
I was posted from 5OTU to as flight commander of A flight in 264 squadron, who were flying Defiance at Duxford. They were stationed at Duxford on the 1st of June. They had been operating over Dunkirk up until the time that I got there, but I arrived just as the Dunkirk evacuation had been completed, and then it was really a case of my getting experience on a Defiant, because I'd never flown one beforehand, and in fact for the squadron to regroup, because although they had done a marvellous job over Dunkirk, they had lost a lot of crews, and so they had to retrain new crews, including myself. After about 2 or 3 weeks, we were dispersed from Duxford to Falmir, where we lived in tented accommodation, and the aircraft were kept on the aerodrome. We flew from Falmir from then on. The work was largely training new pilots, but we also did a considerable number of convoy patrols.
What was the Defiant like as an aeroplane?
It was like a very big Hurricane, but I hadn't at that stage even flown a Hurricane. It was infinitely heavier to feel than a Spitfire, of course. But it was surprisingly manoeuvrable. But it was a totally different... tactics had to be employed compared with the Spitfire, of course, because the Spitfire had forward-firing guns and the Defiant had the power turret with basically rearward firing or sideways firing guns, although it could fire forward at an angle of about 45 degrees. There's little doubt about it that when it was first in action over Dunkirk, it gave the Germans a very nasty surprise to find something was shooting out of its side at them.
Yes.
But the German fighter pilots, of course, eventually twigged what was going on, and then I think the Defiant really became rather less successful, because if your gunner is firing to the side against an enemy aircraft, the other side was totally vulnerable to a beam attack by a fighter, because one's attention was focused in the opposite direction. You didn't even see them coming. After July the 23rd, in fact, 264 squadron moved up to Curtin Lindsay, where we continued training by day and night, and we had detachments over at Manchester to protect Manchester during both day and night. And of course we did a lot of convoy work on the east coast, off the Humber.
Did you see much action at all while you was on convoy work?
No, not really, not a lot. going back a bit, there was one day when I was with 611 Squadron at Digby, the first really big convoy attack took place off the Humber with seaplanes, and number 46 Squadron with then Squadron Leader Barwell, who is the brother of Eric Barwell, who was of 264 Squadron,
yes.
But he shot, I think, one or two down and was awarded the one of the first DFCs, I think, of the war. But to revert to 264 Squadron, we didn't see any action, really, at that time, until on the 21st of August we were shipped down to Hornchurch, which was then at the height of that phase of the Battle of Britain where Germans were attacking our airfields.
Yeah.
And we were in the thick of it then. We had a number of operations, and we suffered very heavily at that time, so much so, in fact, that the squadron was withdrawn on August the 29th. They were only down there for about 9 days, 8 days, by which time we'd lost, I think I'm right in saying, over 50% of our aircraft and a number of crews. I myself was shot down at that time into the sea off Margate, and I'm lucky still to be alive.
How did you get on? Could you remember that incident?
I do, very vividly, actually, but what happened was I was up with two other aircraft. This was a sort of measure of the situation. We'd gone down as a squadron to Manston, and nine aircraft landed to refuel and left one section of three, with my section, up over the aerodrome. And of course, while that happened, a complete squadron of German dive bombers came in, and we attacked them and shot one down, and then got badly hit and set on fire ourselves, and eventually I managed to get the machine upside down and fall out. I thought my gunner had got up, and happily he was never seen again, but we came down in the sea, and we're about 8 miles off land, and just by a stroke of luck, after about an hour, some inshore fisherman had seen a lot of parachutes come down into the sea, and he put his last 2 gallons of petrol in his little motorboat and drove out to pick anyone up, and by the grace of God, it was me he picked up. And we thought that there was one other person, which I hoped and thought was my gunner, and we went and found him, and happily it was a German pilot who we'd brought down, or whether we'd brought him, it was one we'd brought down, or somebody else, I don't know. And we were the only two who were rescued. But it was quite remarkable. Fortunately, the sea was absolutely dead flat calm, and although I could just see land, it was quite surprising the ones picked up. However, as I say, shortly after that, we returned to Curtin Lindsay, and then about a week later, I was posted to 229 Squadron, who were then at Wittering, and I was given command of the squadron. They were Hurricanes, and I had never flown a Hurricane before, so the day I got there, I had a quick circuit of the aerodrome, and the next thing that happened was we received instructions to fly down to Northolt as a squadron, and I took the squadron down there, my second flight in a Hurricane. And no sooner had we landed at North Holt than we were off refueled and off on patrol. And so it went on. We operated from North Holt. Throughout the rest of the Battle of Britain, and saw a good deal of action one way and another, until the 15th of October, which was just a month later, when I also bought it again, and this time landed, fortunately, in an apple tree in Kent. But I had got burnt up that time, and so I ended up in a hospital in East Grinstead. Graduated to the Guinea Pig Club.
Yeah.
Yeah. After that, after I was finally discharged, I was posted to the Air Ministry in the Directorate of Fighter Operations, which is the ministry opposite number of Fighter Command, really, policy department. And my particular job at that time under the director was balloon command. And I had the Air Ministry dealings with balloon command, and was in on the policy operation of balloon command generally.
This is the Barrage balloon.
Barrage balloons. Yes. And while I was there, there were two of us in the particular what they called FO1 office, and one of them was Wing Commander McEvoy, now Air Chief Marshal Sir Theodore McEvoy, who was the most charming man, and we sat in an office together. And after he left there, Wing Commander Stephen Hardy came in. Now Stephen Hardy originally formed 264 Squadron of the Defiance. And after that, he was station commander at Curtin Lindsay when we went up there. So I came across
him. So you knew him?
I knew him very well. And I was in that office for a year until January 1942, when I was posted to the Staff College at Gerrard's Cross for a wartime staff course of 3 months. Very, very intensive study. It really was hard work. And after I'd completed that course, I was posted back to the Air Ministry again, to the same directorate, only this time to a department called FO3, whose responsibility was passive air defence. That was policy regarding camouflage, decoys, smoke screens, and all that sort of thing. Yes. I was there for another year, and then I eventually got back to flying again, went to Cranwell for a refresher course and conversion to twins. After that course, I had to go for a spell of about a month, 2 months to Grantham for conversion to night fighters. And then on to 51 of OTU, Operational Training Unit, for conversion onto bow fighters. After that, in August 43, I was posted supernumerary wing commander to 604 Squadron at Scorton. They were night fighters on bow fighters. And in December of that year, I was posted overseas to 108 Squadron in Malta to command. They had bow fighters at that time. and we re-equipped to Mosquito 8 in February of that year. Again, it's an interesting, I think, reflection on training in those days. Mosquito being a two-seater side by side, I had one ride with the CO of another squadron in a Mosquito. I was in the passenger's seat, so to speak, and he showed me how it worked. And then I landed, and I took the machine over with the instruction book and my radar operator. I handed him the instruction book and said, off we go, and we'll see how we get on. And I can well remember sort of getting him to read out the routine for coming into land as we did our first landing, the first landing I ever did. And in fact, that's of course how we trained our pilots in as they converted from bow fighters. They all had to take the instruction book up with them because we could talk to them beforehand, but
there's no dual control.
There was no dual control, mm-hmm. And that's really how we worked it. We managed it without any accidents, and that was fine.
It's the main thing.
There was one very amusing instrument. Well, not amusing, really. 108 Squadron was the only night fighter squadron in that area of the Mediterranean. And I had to have detachments. We always had a three aircraft detachment at Catania in Sicily for night defense there. And we also had a detachment at a place called Boritzo, which is on the other end of Sicily, the eastern end, for night protection there in the Palermo district. And these aircraft used to fly over there in the evening, do night readiness, and any night flying was necessary, come back again at breakfast time the next morning for servicing. And there was always a very good supply of eggs in Sicily, which were a very short supply in Malta. And we used to take over quantities of Victory V cigarettes, which nobody could smoke, and trade them with the Italians for eggs. And the aircraft used to come back with literally boxes of hundreds of eggs on board, you see, for, you know, the airmen as well as the officers' mess. And I always remember one day a bow fighter came in, made a terribly heavy landing, and the undercarriage collapsed. And the anxiety there was amongst everybody as to all our supply of eggs should be broken. Well, amazingly enough, there were not one egg was broken. But we actually then had a series of heavy landings, and we couldn't make out why, because we naturally questioned everybody, had an inquiry as to why they were making heavy landings with these bow fighters. And the same answer was the same from everybody. I came in at the right airspeed, and we couldn't make it out. But eventually, we discovered that there was a bee which started making a honeycomb,
yes,
in the pitot head, in the static side of the pitot head. And of course, if the pressure built up and the airspeed indicator registered 100 knots. But of course, as the pressure dropped down, the static tube didn't let the air go out, you see. The beeswax kept it up, so the airspeed indicator needle continued to register very slow, a long way behind the actual speed. So if you were coming, making an approach at 100 knots, you could in fact drop down to 70 knots while the indicator still showed the same. And so from then onwards, we found we had to stick a cork in the into the hole in the aircraft to keep the bees out. It's interesting. Eventually, one time I had I think the most dispersed squadron in the Air Force. I had three aircraft in Catania, three at Naples, three in Sardinia, and three in Cairo, all on the same night or same week, which was a fairly widespread command on the whole.
Yes,
I left the 108 squadron in the July of 44 and was posted to 286 wing at Grottaglie in the heel of Italy as wing commander, and was eventually promoted to group captain there in August of that year. And as that wing was in part of the what was called MACAF, Mediterranean Command Air Force, I think, or something like that. No, Mediterranean Coastal Air Force. And I had a batch of squadrons there, one fighter squadron, Spitfire, two light bomber squadrons, and a Wellington squadron. And our job was partially air defense and partially sea well, anti-shipping in the Adriatic. We operated there in Grottaglie. Protection of Taranto, of course, was the main job. From there in October, I was posted to base area in Naples to command the base area there, which had just been formed, which was a purely admin unit, which looked after every conceivable unit that nobody else wanted to look after.
Yes.
You know, transit camps,
yes.
RDF stations, rest camps, police, you name it, they all came under base area. And I was there for about 3 months, and then I went up to 287 wing as commander, which was based at Ancona. And there we operated immediately behind the Desert Air Force, protection of their base. And had a very interesting time up there, because again the role was partially air defense and partially anti-shipping. And I stayed there until the end of the war, the war in Europe, and folded up the wing eventually. I shared that station with the Americans, in fact, the base finally, or the Air Force part of it, finally closed down in July of 1945, when I went back to base area again until November, when I was demobbed.
Were you demobbed? Did you come home to be demobbed?
Yes.
Where did you come home to?
In Staffordshire, in the middle of Staffordshire somewhere. What's the name of that? Cannock. There was an air station at Cannock.
Staffordshire, Cannock Chase.
Cannock Chase, yes.
Yeah.
I think it was an officer's demob area up there. And I finished in November.